meeting is now being recorded.
Good morning, good afternoon, good evening, everybody, and welcome to the new GTLD Subsequent Procedures Sub-Team Track 3 call on Wednesday, 20th of December, 2016. In the interest of time today, there will be no roll call, and we'll take attendance only via the Adobe Connect room. So if you have connected via your telephone only and are not in the Adobe Connect room, please let yourself be known now.
I'm still only on audio at Sherling, but I'll be in the IT room shortly.
Thank you very much, Cheryl. Noted. And hearing no one else, I would like to remind you all to please state your names before speaking for transcription and recording purposes, and please keep your phones and microphones on silence when not speaking to avoid any background noise. And with this, I'll hand it over to Robin Gross. Thank you, Robin. Over to you.
Thank you so much, and welcome everyone to the Work Team 3 meeting here the day before the December solstice. So I appreciate everyone showing up at this time of year. Let me quickly review the agenda. We've got an update to our SOIs. Avery will provide us with an update from the full working group. We will then do a recap and positioning on the limited public interest objections, including the content and function for purpose of the policy stated in the applicant guidebook, the needs with regard to the future implementation, the issue of ALAC having standing to file, the issue of the process possibly inviting lobbying from third parties, and then we'll talk about legal rights objections, in particular Principle G, Recommendation 3. We had a few materials to look at for this discussion that were pretty helpful. The objection statistics with links to the results of those cases, the WIPO final report on the legal rights objections, and an inter report on ICANN's legal rights objections. We'd like to talk also about the community objections and Recommendation 20, in particular whether the process was fair to both communities and applicants, and some have raised concern about the process inviting gaming of applications, so if we could have a discussion on that. Any other business, Paul submitted a document this morning that I think we could talk about with some of the concerns that he has and a possible solution. So I'm hoping he can tell us about that document in broad terms. And then confirmation of our next meeting time. So this is what we have on our agenda for today. I don't know if anyone has any questions on that, or if you'd like to add anything or have any comments on the agenda, now is a good time to do that. Okay, well, I don't see any hands or hear any voices, so I will just go through the beginning. So if there is anyone who has any updates to their statements of interest, now is a good time to please raise your hand and let us know. Okay, I don't see any hands or hear any voices, so we can move on to the next agenda item. Avery Doria, who is one of the co-chairs of the full working group, is with us and can update us on what's going on in the full working group. Avery?
Hi, this is Aubrey speaking. So just a quick update. The last meeting basically focused on completing the first reading of the CC1, the community comments, one of the overarching issues. And we managed to finally complete that process. So that was a big milestone for us because we wanted to complete that in 2016. The next step in that process will be for Jeff and I working with Steve and Emily and Julie and others. We'll try to pull together a first draft of the document that recommends things from that, so that can be discussed sometime in the new year. But that was a great achievement. The other thing that happened, and people should look at it, is we initiated a quick poll on changing the rotation schedule so that we would take the 3 UTC on Mondays out of the rotation and replace it with a Tuesday 3 UTC, so that people in the UTC minus zones, sort of the people to the west of UTC, would not be having a meeting on their Sunday. And that's about it for now. And, you know, we'll be starting up again in the new year. Thank you.
Great. Thanks very much, Aubrey. Does anyone have any questions or comments for Aubrey on that? Okay, I don't see any hands, hear any voices. So let's go on with issue number 4 in the agenda, recap and positioning on the limited public interest objections. Last week, I know we had a very interesting discussion on some of these limited public interest objections, and it sounded like there was there seemed to be some consensus around there not being major changes that needed to be made with respect to those. I was just wanting to open that up for discussion and see if folks agree or disagree around a coalescing consensus on that issue. Okay, I don't hear any voices or see any hands on this. So it sounds like there was some discussion last week about whether the term generally, that the way it's used in defining the limited public interest objections might not be the best term to be used, and there was some thought that we might want to think about a different interpretation of that, and I'm just wondering if there's any movement on that or additional discussion about that issue. Okay, I don't hear anyone or see any hands. We've got a quiet bunch today, but that's okay. It means that it sounds like we can just continue with the work as it's been proceeding thus far. So that's good. There was also some discussion about the issue of ALAC being given funding to participate in the limited public interest objections process, but then not having standing when they did file such an objection, and so that this may be a concern to deal with. So I'd like to raise this issue again and see if there's anyone who'd like to comment on this particular issue. Okay, I see Alan's got his hand up. Alan, please, go ahead.
Not really a comment, just a piece of information. It will be discussed on an AOT call immediately after this. Probably no decision taken, but I'm starting to raise it with the ALAC to what extent they believe that we should continue the process or change it or delete it or whatever. So we'll be coming back to the group with as that proceeds.
Thanks very much, Alan. I actually have a question for you, because I'm presuming you know more about this particular issue than most of us, having been in ALECA and raised it with the group last week. And I'm wondering how the panel does the issue. Like, how I haven't read this particular opinion. I'm not sure which one it would be, but I'd like to, because I'm very curious how, you know, sort of what was the rationale for how the panel could, on the one hand, conclude that ALEC did not have standing, but on the other hand, recognize that the process created a mechanism for ALEC to object. So I'm just kind of curious.
Well,
maybe you don't know, but I'd be interested
to
know.
No, I do know. If you look at the independent objector, the independent objector was deemed to have standing on anything. So the independent objector could object to, you know, .Amazon, even though he didn't necessarily represent a government in that jurisdiction, who was claiming to have a conflicting need for it. The ALAC was given funding in the new GTLD process, but we were not given standing, like the independent objector. So perhaps not unreasonably, when we actually filed an objection, the panel looked at whether the ALAC was actually an involved party, because to file a public interest objection, you have to have some involvement in the issue. They decided we didn't. It turns out we filed objections on .health. We were not an organization associated with health support in any way, in any national or other jurisdiction, and we're deemed not to have standing. So it was literally a classic catch-22, that we put half of the requirements into the applicant guidebook, but didn't actually say we could use the money productively. So as it stands, it was essentially a waste of time, and a waste of money, unless we happened to be filing an objection which somehow was closely tied to at large or ICANN or you, perhaps users. But users is a relatively nebulous one and hard to prove you have standing in that area. So if, from my perspective, it makes sense either to do it properly and give ALAC standing, or remove the other half of it, because half of it without the other half just doesn't make a lot of sense at this point. And to be honest, none of us thought about it at the time. If we had, perhaps it would have been done differently.
Okay, thanks. I mean, you know, maybe an argument could be made that it just sort of, you know, fell through the cracks, and it sounds like it just wasn't, that this aspect of it maybe wasn't spelled out in the applicant guidebook and sufficiently, such that the panelists were comfortable with that, making that determination.
Yeah, no, it's quite clear. The only reference to ALAC is on a matter of funding, not on a matter of standing when the public interest objection is listed, nor was there a section on ALAC filing an objection as there was under the independent objector. So, yes, very much fell between the cracks, and the question is, how do we fix it right now? And that's what we need to start discussing. But I thought, to start with, the ALAC should be able to weigh in on this. And, you know, maybe the decision will be, it was a waste of our time, we don't want to do that again, in which case it's an easy answer. If the answer is different, then we have a discussion to have in this group and probably the wider GTLD process group.
Okay, great. Thank you. And I apologize for the very noisy street cleaner going by at the moment, that loud noise that you hear. Okay, so I see we've got a queue. Greg, please, you've got the floor.
Thanks. Greg Shatton, for the record. I wish I had more depth of knowledge or reading on this, but you know, I'm curious as to whether there was a statement of why ALAC was given the funding, and maybe the intent was just to fund ALAC where they would otherwise have standing to object. So maybe it didn't fall through the cracks, and wasn't intended to be a general purpose objection right like the independent objector. but was intended to basically fund those things for which the internet user at large, so to speak, would have standing to object. Now, I don't know whether the particular determination on standing took into account the fact that AILAC was objecting on behalf of the end user as a concept, or it may be that because of the nature of the dot health that they took the view that an end user group, whether it was funded or not, did not have standing to object, and therefore, you know, the question is, if we're going to get into kind of creating rights or standing to object that are separate from those of the reason the group exists, that's kind of, you know, gets us into a different area, rather than saying that, you know, this is a group that should have standing to object in certain places but will certainly not have funding to object, and therefore we're going to make sure that that standing is made meaningful by funding. And that's certainly one way to look at it, rather than the idea that there's not somehow they missed giving us standing for stuff that we wouldn't otherwise have standing for. Thanks.
Thank you. So, yeah, it sounds like maybe these were meant to be separate, or possibly meant to be separate questions and not to be presumed standing because there's funding or vice versa. I have to be honest, I don't exactly remember the details of what we had decided that all went down. I'd need to go back and look at what we did back then. I see Alan's got his hand back up. Alan, please come in.
Yeah, thank you. I don't think we'll find a document because I don't think it was actively discussed. Certainly the presumption from the point of view of at large and AILAC was we would file objections similarly to what we might give advice to the board on, in that you know, this is something which was potentially harmful to users or put users at some level of risk or confusion. So just like we filed board advice on the confusingly similar issue, this was a similar one. But it wasn't clear, obviously, to the panelists that because it involved users of, issues related to user harm, that we had standing. They looked at it more from the subject matter instead of just the concept of users. So one way or another, it has to be clarified or withdrawn, and that's the point that I raised, and you know, we'll proceed on that. I'm not sure more discussion at this point is warranted until we find out if the AILAC indeed wants to continue it. If the AILAC says it was a pain in the butt, we don't want to do it again, we waive the right, then this group's work is easy. So I would suggest we wait until we at least have that determination before going forward.
Okay, thank you. Paul, you're next. Please, come in.
Thanks, Paul McGrady. So I hear Alan, and I understand wanting to understand the threshold response of the AILAC before we move further on this, but just so that I can start thinking about this and others too, I'm just curious if what the overlap was between the AILAC and the independent objector, not necessarily in the ones that panelists let the AILAC keep, but, you know, what was filed. Because I walked away from the independent objector process thinking that was, I thought that was a pretty bizarre thing, and we spent a lot of money on it, and the outcomes were pretty weird. And so I'm just wondering, you know, if the AILAC essentially filed for the same things that the independent objector did, even though they may not have been able to keep the complaints, does that show that there's a redundancy here? And if so, do we need both? I don't know if anybody knows the answer to that. I guess I can go back and dig through the complaints, but I thought somebody may know off the top of their head. Thanks.
Thanks very much. Yeah, I think that would be very interesting data to take a look at as well. Okay, next in the queue, we've got Aubrey, and then, okay, just go ahead, Aubrey.
Thanks, Aubrey speaking. Yeah, just to go back a little, I think that the independent objector was specifically to be able to pick up the objections from anyone who had no other way to object and such, and was supposed to basically deal with those issues. I think that at large, just like all the other ACs, had the ability to object to things that were within their area of concern. And now that was sort of, you know, a fuzzy border, but everything in that round was based essentially on fuzzy borders, because trying to define sharp, crisp edges was extremely difficult. And it was left to the judgment of panels to decide whether something actually fell within their area of concern or didn't. So I actually think the mechanism did work as it was intended to. The at-large is there to make objections based upon, as Alan said, the concerns of their members, of the at-large user. But whereas, you know, the independent objector would be someone that fell outside all the categories and such, you know. For example, ALAC doesn't cover those who are not currently users, and yet the name somehow injures them, or the name somehow confuses them or puts them in a dangerous position, you know, just as an example. So I think they are different. I think they both have their roles. Something may need to be said about how IOs are selected and what process an IO uses, because that was not said at all. But I do think they do occupy different positions, and it's probably good to perhaps tighten up the descriptions as we move along. I'd be surprised. I think it's weird to ask somebody to waive the right of objection at this point, but of course if the group wants to, or if the group wants to voluntarily say, no, we don't want the ability to object, that's interesting, but I'm not sure that that's the best way to be looking at this at the moment. Thanks.
Thank you. Okay, I don't see anyone else in the queue or hear any other voices weighing in on this. Another issue related to this that had been raised, I think it was on the email list in the last week from Jeff, was the extent to which does this limited public interest objection process invite gaming, possibly of community from outside third parties. And so there was a suggestion that we may want to discuss that aspect and see if there needs to be changes made in the policy that could address that issue. Anybody want to speak to that issue? Okay, well, I don't hear any voices or see any.
I'm sorry, could you restate
hands.
The question? Could you restate the question?
Well, sure. Some concerns had been raised on the list about the limited public interest objection process inviting gaming of third parties, and I think somebody raised an example of, I think it was, and I'm sorry if I get these facts wrong, but I believe it was the World Health Organization lobbying ALAC to put forward an objection, and there was some concern that it might be a problem that we need to deal with. And so I wanted to bring that issue back to the meeting and pick up that discussion and see if anyone had any comments on that issue. Is that any clearer? I hope.
No, I was.
Okay, I see Alan's got his hand. Pardon me?
I was just multitasking.
Okay. Okay, Alan, please go ahead.
Thank you very much. There was an allegation that we were being gamed, that we, ALAC, were being gamed, and, you know, pressured into doing something. There is no question that in this particular case, the World Health Organization is one of the groups that brought this to our attention. Now, whether we were pressured by them to do something or influenced by them to do something, one can debate. I believe, in retrospect, that we carried out our due diligence and made a decision on whether we wanted to file an objection. So were we pressured to do it or forced to do it or you know, paid to do it by them because they didn't want to do their own objection? No. Did they talk to us and did they alert us to the issue? Yes. So I don't think that's gaming, but everyone's entitled to their own opinion.
Okay. Thank you very much. Thank you. And I see Paul types in the chat, isn't the WHO an end user? Can't an end user ask the ALEC for help? I guess I don't see the gaming. So, that sounds like our comments as well as, what is gaming and what is the appropriate issue awareness raising, perhaps. And I think we do need to be conscientious that it's a fuzzy line and, setting down hard and fast rules is difficult. But at the same time, we also want to be aware that we don't want to set ourselves up for a process that makes it easy for perhaps less accountable, less transparent, activities, in ICANN's name. So, anybody else wanted to weigh in on this issue? Okay, I see Greg's got his hand up. Please, Greg, come in.
Oh, Robin?
Perhaps fools rush in
yes.
Or angels fear to tread, and it sounds like Kieran may be getting in the queue as well.
I was just going to point
okay.
out Steve's hand's been up.
I see
Steve's
that.
Hand has a hand. Yes, Steve's hand actually went up before mine, so why don't you go to Steve.
I'm looking in the wrong place then. I apologize. Steve, please go ahead.
Thanks, Robin. This is Steve from Staffen. I can see how my hand can get lost above the line. I just wanted to perhaps maybe clarify for maybe even for myself, but my understanding was that question D about the process inviting lobbying was, and I think Alan made this pretty clear in his response, that question was in relation to the ALEC funding and standing issues, and it wasn't an independent topic. At least that was my understanding of how it was described. So I guess I just wanted to try to clarify that or even clarify for myself what I said. Thanks.
Thank you, Steve. Appreciate that. Greg, please, you have the floor now.
Thanks. And I perhaps fools rush in where angels fear to tread, but I think that without, looking at the gaming question without finger pointing and without allegations or, suppositions, it is something to be concerned about. And I guess, on the other hand, one could be more clear about how, if ALAC is funded again, kind of, what their process would be, and one could even say that it's entirely appropriate for things to be brought to their attention, so long as ALAC goes through its own process and determines that it's an issue that needs to be brought on behalf of the end user, thereby, in essence, removing any kind of thought that would be considered to be inappropriate. and you know, trust that the ALAC, no matter how they learn about a particular use, is going to exercise their remit according to their user community and their and within their appropriate bounds. That's entirely separate from whether there should be funding for ALAC and only ALAC to bring objections, and if so, what those objections should be and what that the level whether they should be given standing separate from what their standing might be, or if the standing needs to be clarified, even if it's not enlarged. And of course, you know, if in fact the ALAC felt that they had standing in the cases where they were told they didn't have standing, you know, it may have been entirely a rigorous and good faith analysis, and then you just get somebody disagreeing with it who, you know, who's in the panel. The panelists disagreed. You know, one of the problems with this whole system is we set up kind of a whole judicial system of first impression. Like the Wright brothers' first airplane, parts of it didn't get off the ground all that well, and other parts got off and crashed. So, you know, I think we have, as we come back and look at this, you have to look at this entire kind of, you know, mini courthouse square that we created, because it definitely needs a revisit overall. Thanks.
Thank you very much, Greg. Let me just read a couple of the comments here in the chat. We've got some robust discussion on this. Kieran says, I honestly don't understand how we can call anything gaming. This is an open process. Organizations have ever engaged in the process. And also, I think there's a tendency at ICANN to devalue certain voices, corporations, organizations, et cetera. And I think that's dangerous. Multi-stakeholder is multi-stakeholder. Anna Beth Lang says, for me, gaming is something very different from what we are talking about now. I must be allowed to make a stakeholder group aware of a problem. Okay. So it does sound like, oh, and there's another comment. Paul agrees, says gaming is something sinister, and users making ALAC aware of a concern is not. Okay, so it sounds like we've had a lot of very similar perspective on put forward on this particular issue. Did anyone else want to weigh in, or can we move on the agenda? Okay, let's move on then to the issue number 5, legal rights objections, from Principle G, Recommendation 3 in the guidebook. Has anyone had a chance to take a look at some of the statistics and links to the cases? Let me pull those up quickly. We've got some interesting data to look at. Okay, on the legal rights objections, it looks like there were about 69 of them that were filed in total, and about of these disputes, the objector prevailed in only 4 cases, and the applicant prevailed in the vast majority, specifically 59 of the cases. So 4 for the objector and 59 for the applicant. That's a pretty interesting. That's a pretty interesting statistic. We also had let's see, some of these different some reports that had been put forward by the International Trademark Association, INTA. And then also the World Intellectual Property Organization, WIPO, and they did some analysis of some of the different types of cases that had been brought, and it looked like there were basically four different types of cases generally that most of them could be broken down into trademarks that overlap with common terms or dictionary terms, which had a similar outcome. There was also abbreviated trademarks that overlap with dictionary terms. Another group were the dot trademark cases, and that was another group of cases that had been filed. And then internationalized domain names and foreign marks was another type of group, as well as the brand versus the brand cases. So some of these analyses were actually pretty interesting and did come up with some pretty hard data and interesting evaluations. I don't know if anybody else wanted to talk about some of these reports. Okay, does anybody want to comment on any of these materials or some of the decisions that the expert panels have come away with on these legal rights objections cases? It looks like for the most part, overwhelmingly the applicants prevailed. Does that mean that they were not very legitimate cases that had been brought, or that the process worked because the issues were resolved before it got to an end point? Okay, I see Paul's got his hand up. Paul, please go ahead.
Thanks. Paul McGrady here. So that's the temptation, right? To say that we had an overwhelming number of applicants prevail, and therefore the cases must have been no good, right? Or draw some other conclusion from that statistic standing alone that we may not be able to draw because we really didn't take a look at each and every case individually and essentially come to the conclusion whether or not the panelists got it right or wrong. So all I can do is give you my perspective as someone who practices in this space and who considered filing legal rights objections, and I mentioned this a little bit in the prior call, which is I think one of the reasons why the complainants lost is because the legal rights objection is not really tailored to do its job. And, in fact, on the last call, I don't want to speak for Kurt, but I think it was Kurt who said that folks actually saw that in advance, that it really was meant only to help the most arbitrary marks in the most grievous circumstances. Kurt, if I'm overstating it, please correct the record. But the way the policy itself, the objections process itself is written, you know, the elements had to do with infringement, and of course infringement has to do with use rather than mere applications. It just really was not a useful policy, and so I just think that some complainants raced in thinking it would help them, and they learned pretty quickly that it would not. And so instead of trying to guess whether the panelists got it wrong or whether the complainant got it wrong or the applicant got it right or whatever, I would suggest that we step back and sort of look at the policy itself and try to get something that's tailored for its purpose so that you can have complainants in the future who can file a complaint and believe that they're going to get a fair shake this time around. So I'll be quiet now, but just to note that I put forward purely as a straw man, some suggested changes to the policy itself that I think would make it useful in the future. And again, not as like a list of things that, you know, that anybody's demanding or must-haves, but just to get us talking about the substance of this policy, because I think this is one spot where we need to do some significant reworking if we're going to end up with something that protects consumers at the end of the day. Thanks.
Thanks very much for that. I see Kurt's got his hand up. Kurt, please go ahead. I don't hear Kurt. Kurt, are you speaking? Do others hear Kurt? Okay, Kurt's going to try later. One of the issues that related to this that had come out in these reports is the issue of proving bad faith and the difficulty that is when we're talking about preparing for new GTLD registries. And so I just wanted to sort of throw that issue out here and see if that was something that folks agreed with or thought we needed to address. It sounded like that's some one of the issues that Paul has raised in his proposal and with a possible solution. Anybody else wanted to weigh in on this issue? Okay, I don't see anyone on that with their hand up or hear any voices. So, I see Paul has typed in that bad faith can only be inferred from the facts unless a party admits to it, so we need more inference points. Okay, that's very helpful. I see Greg's got his hand up, and Nathaniel Edwards has his hand up as well. So let's go to Greg. Oops, wait, we've got a change there. Greg took his hand down, but it's back up. Greg, you're confusing me. Okay, Nathaniel, you're up.
Hi, this is Nathaniel Edwards. It seems to me that the legal rights objections were nearly impossible to win from the mark owner's standpoint, because if a trademark was found to have a dictionary meaning, many of the panelists concluded that there was no bad faith, including one instance where I believe it was Donuts and their subsidiaries had applied for .coach, .express, and one other relatively famous clothing or apparel brand, and it seems to me that the combined effect of those three applications for at least arguably famous trademarks in the U.S. should have resulted in a finding of bad faith. But I think my point is I would agree with Paul that we need more points for an inference of bad faith. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Greg, please, you have the floor.
Thanks. Greg Shatton for the record. And I think, you know, a lot of this stems from the fact that the standards that were being applied were kind of a hash. I think Paul alluded to that as well. And on top of that, the, you know, issues of whether to what extent there be precedential value in any decisions that were made. You know, it's a real challenge to decide what the jurisprudence is and what's being judged here, but you know, it's not the only place where we're discussing the concept that some may have, you know, that somehow dictionary words have more limited rights as trademarks, and you know that you know, so I don't doubt that that was codified into there. So there was, that's kind of just some filling in the blanks by the panel. So you know, it seems it kind of comes back again to this, you know, attempt to kind of slap up a series of courthouses and put some law books into them of a sort. But that, you know, I think this is going to need some really careful review, because I don't know that any of them really got it right at all. So I don't know what our intention is, you know, in this work track or in the group at all, you know, to really kind of dig in to these and you know, look at the documentation that was created. You know, even following the Newman rule, I think these are broke enough that they deserve fixing, and even conceptually, the you know, need to be reviewed in this in a sense. Almost thinking that this one should be dealt with by the RPM review group, but you know, it doesn't really, who has jurisdiction over this doesn't really matter so much as the fact that it gets a thorough review. Thanks.
Thanks very much, Greg. Just to play devil's advocate a little bit and push back a little bit on this issue, particularly where it comes to common, ordinary dictionary words, you know, one of the courts, one of the panels said that the, quote, the objector faces this risk because it adopted a common term in the English language for its trademark. So, you know, to some extent, the panel said, didn't have a whole lot of sympathy for, trademark, claims when it's a, we're talking about a generic word that maybe a lot of people have trademarks to in different, jurisdictions or different niche products. And so, you know, they don't want to necessarily take that, common term out of, common use and give it an exclusive right in the GTLD space. Let me also just type in or read some of these comments that people have typed in to the chat. Avery says, I think trying to decide that a decision of a panel was right or wrong is tough, since there are two sides at least to each of the cases. We can more look for places where different panels seemed to decide similar cases in a contradictory manner. Kurt adds, abuse or infringement is generally demonstrated through use, and there is no use at the application stage, as Paul has said, but we should take care not to make a process that is more easily winnable just to balance out the results. There should be real infringement before an application is defined. And Paul says, I think abuse can be shown without the use, as can dilution. Infringement is based on use, though. Kurt asks, has the delegation of .coach or .express resulted in abuse? I think that's actually an important question. You know, did these decisions come out wrong? Do we think they were wrong, or were they decided fairly considering all the facts? Paul says, purses.coach leads to PPC ads, so yes, and says, Robin, we should be careful with throwing around terms like generic. Okay, well, I'm just using the words that were in the Inter report that were citing the expert panel decision. So I do agree with you. That is a very somewhat ambiguous term, but it did seem to be a factor that the panels took into consideration. Kurt says the RPM can be used with that specific example for purse.coach, but all legitimate uses of a .coach name should not be barred. Nathaniel says, yes, but because a trademark is a dictionary term does not mean that it is not arbitrary or fanciful trademark entitled to broad protection. Google had a dictionary meaning before it was a trademark. And Greg adds, wallets.coach and handbags.coach do the same. Okay, so we've got some real robust discussion going on in the chat here. Anybody want to take the floor and articulate some of this a little bit further, because I think this is actually a really interesting question for us to look at. Okay, well, I don't see any hands or voices, so this really kind of takes us to the issue of do we feel like the process, the legal rights objection process overall, is it fair to the applicants and the communities? Does it invite gaming of applications? I'm sorry, I just accidentally skipped ahead to the community objections. I apologize. Was there anything anybody else wanted to add on the legal rights objections? Okay, I see Paul's got his hand up. Paul, please, go ahead.
Thanks, Paul McGrady here. So I was asked on the last call to go through and make some concrete suggestions about how to improve the legal rights objections, and I circulated around a marked up version of the appropriate sections from the guidebook, which I'm happy to walk through, and just to pull out some of these ideas and to see, you know, just start some discussion about how we would fix these kinds of things. Robin, should I do that now, or would that be on a later call? When would be the appropriate time to do that?
Thanks, Paul.
Well, now is probably a good time because we are focused on the legal rights objections. We are sort of talking about this issue of intent. And, so please just give us a quick broad overview of that. That'd be wonderful. Thank you. And thanks for your work on this.
You bet. So just to start, in the 3.2.2.2, which is more of an introductory paragraph, made a couple of changes. I changed a rights holder to any rights holder just to make sure that it was as universal as we'd hoped it would be. I swapped out the word infringed for abused because I think you can show abuse without use. And abuse is a broader category than infringement. Certainly infringement is a kind of abuse, but it's not the it's not even the primary kind of abuse in domain name law. Cyber squatting is the primary abuse kind of abuse in domain name law, and cyber squatting has different elements than infringement does. And so that's why I swapped that out. That word infringed is, I think, caused a lot of people to take a pass on using this. And then I went down, and by the way, for anybody who is on the call that works for an intergovernmental organization, I did not touch those sections under the theory that interested parties may be wanting to do that on their own, and I didn't particularly want to wade into that issue. So that's why there are no changes there. And then I took a look at Section 3.5.2, and there are various things that the panel could look at to determine whether or not the potential use of the applied-for GTLD takes unfair advantage of the distinctive character or the reputation of the objector's registered or unregistered trademarks. I think that's interesting there that we specifically say distinctive character, which would, I think, tend to support the idea that folks who are more concerned about dictionary terms, but at the same time, the phrase or reputation certainly indicates that a trademark, as we all know, can exceed its dictionary term. You know, there is a dictionary term for coach in a dictionary, but of course, it is not doesn't mean purse in the dictionary. And so, certainly, something like coach has a reputation. At least in the U.S. and in many of the ex-U.S. places that I've traveled. So, I think that some of the panels may have gotten it wrong by simply ignoring or the reputation of. But again, we really hard to go back and unpack what the experts were up to in those cases. I thought it was important to add on an additional item to show the kinds of abusive filings. And so I added at the end, after acronym, or was filed for the purpose of triggering a private auction proceeding designed to obtain a payment from the objector. I do believe there were cases like that where people filed for well-known brands and the goal was to either to essentially to be paid off to withdraw the application. I think that especially after we're through round one here and whatever process we end up in for the future, I think we can expect more of that, especially if we do rounds or windows instead of an open process. I think an open process sort of, you know, first to file defeats a lot of this concern right here. But if we don't do first to file, then we are going to have this ongoing concern. I think that we need to firm up that the applied for GTLD is identical, similar, or a translation or transliteration of the objector's existing mark. I think that, you know, you could have a mark that is English but could be translated or transliterated into a foreign language, or not, I shouldn't say foreign, not English language, and that could be a means to take advantage of a well-known brand, or vice versa. To the extent, paragraph three, I think it's important to carve out the idea of niche market fame here. There is a, again, the mark, especially if we have common law rights or concerns about, you know, the extent of geographic registrations. It's important to save space for trademarks that are famous. I think that, you know, example of a mark comes, you know, there's this famous Telstra UDRP case, and so I always think about them. Apparently they're very well known in Australia. I don't live in Australia, so I don't really know anything about them, but I think that they would view their mark as famous or well known in their geographic niche or their market niche for their goods and services. And then four goes to bad faith. Again, how do we discern applicants' bad faith? So applicants' intent in applying for the GTLD, including, and I would just get rid of this knowledge issue because no applicant's going to admit that they, you know, if they applied in bad faith, they're not, you know, there is no discovery, so you can't put them under oath and say, did you know about the trademark? There's no method to do that, and they're not going to make an admission against interest by admitting that they did, and so we should just do something objective, like did you conduct a trademark search in advance? That's sort of a fact, right, yes or no. If you didn't and you applied for somebody's mark and you should have known about them, that's perhaps a sign of bad faith. I would say if the objection is based on common law rights, whether or not the applicant knew or should have known about the objector's mark, again, you know, some common law rights can come up in searches. Other common law rights are not. And so, for example, if we had an applicant that was based in Japan and an objector who was based in Australia, and the applicant from Japan had really no reason to know about an Australian company's common law marks, well, that would go in the applicant's favor in this case. The C, I don't think I changed anything to D, whether or not the applicant is engaged in past private auctions designed to raise funds from competing applications. I almost should, even as I see this, I really should change it to competing applications, you know, from applicants who claim rights to a brand. That the way it's written is just too sloppy, but you get the idea. You know, we don't want to create a class of applicants who apply and use the system just to draw money out of folks. But I would say that could use some significant narrowing now that I read it out loud. And E, whether or not the applicant or any officer, board member, others have been involved in essentially a series of UDRP complaints or other kinds of domain name abuses. I put this in here because although we have a provision for this in the applicant guidebook, for whatever reason, the evaluators just didn't really care about making that enforced. And so I think I think it's a good idea, but I don't think as long as it's left to evaluators who don't really care to do anything about it, it's essentially a paragraph that has no meaning, so I think it should end up here where a complaining party could bring it up as one of the factual indicia of bad faith. So, and then paragraph five, I would say we should limit this paragraph to where we have a string that does not correspond to a famous trademark owned by the objector. I think that and that the bona fide goods and services offering that they're preparing to do would necessarily need to be related must be for unrelated goods or services. I think that it's going to be really hard in the case of famous trademarks to figure out, you know, what in the world good bona fide use you could put to a mark like, you know, I hate to just pull one out of the air, but Chrysler. I mean, you know, there are some marks that are just so, and, you know, Jeep, just so globally famous that it's hard to imagine that. But then there are all kinds of other marks that if the applicant really has a business plan that is in the application that is unrelated to those goods and services, then, you know, you could see that showing up and being an important factor for the panel to consider. And I know we're out of time. Lastly, we have the applicant itself has marks or other intellectual property. And again, here just some language here about the need to narrowly tailor the use cases for these registries so as not to bump up against trademark rights. So, for example, let's take the hypothetical .coach application. I would say that we would need something that would make sure that we didn't end up with purses.coach and other kinds of abuses. So, anyways, long story short, I think if everybody could read through this, I think that would be terrific, and maybe we could talk about it when we have more time. Thanks.
Great. Thank you very much for that, Paul. I really appreciate that. And I do, and I'm sorry that we don't have more time to discuss it right now, but we are over time now. So let me just close us up, and thank you all for joining. We didn't get to wrap up the community objections, but we can pick up with that issue next time at our next meeting, which I believe is January 17th at 300 UTC. So that will be our next Work Track 3 meeting. And thank you all for joining, and have a good holiday season to everyone. Thanks. Bye-bye.
Thank you very much. This concludes today's call. Thank you for joining.